I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Rolling Stone writer Matt Taibbi looked long and hard at the nation's ever-widening wealth gap and found disparities not only in income, but in how Americans are treated by the criminal justice system. Matt Taibbi joins us in the second hour of today's show. Up front, we welcome your thoughts on the National Basketball Association's action against Donald Sterling for racial comments the owner of the Los Angeles Clippers made during a recorded conversation. Culture and media critic Sherry Parks joins us, and we'll hear from Hopkins professor Nathan Connolly. He specializes in racism, capitalism, and property rights. Does this latest episode in our long struggle with racism reflect the shifting of power to a more diverse generation of citizens? Please join us for the conversation after the news. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. The New York Times reports that federal prosecutors are preparing criminal charges that could produce the first guilty plea from the leadership of a major bank in more than two decades. If that happens, it will puncture the popular belief confirmed through the financial crisis that Wall Street institutions have grown so important to the economy they cannot be charged. A lack of criminal prosecutions during the Obama administration has contributed to the perception that Wall Street giants are too big to jail. Journalist Matt Taibbi says it's not just a perception, it's real. There's one system of justice for the wealthy and one for everyone else. It has a new dynamic today that he'll be talking to us about in the second hour of our show when Matt Taibbi, a long time with Rolling Stone, joins us to talk about his new book. In this hour, we open the phone lines for your comments about the matter of Donald Sterling, the owner of the Los Angeles Clippers, whose racist attitudes and remarks about African-Americans were revealed last week by the celebrity news website TMZ. Yesterday, the commissioner of the National Basketball Association, Adam Silver, said that Sterling's remarks contradicted the NBA's principles of inclusion and respect that form the foundation of our diverse, multicultural, and multi-ethnic league. Silver issued a $2.5 million fine and banished Sterling for life from team and league business and urged the other owners to vote to force him to sell the club. If you find that remarkable, you are not alone. The question is, will it hold up? Sterling will fight to keep the team. A legal battle looms. This case has been the talk of the nation since the weekend. Even President Obama and Oprah have commented on it. Today, we want to hear from you. So here are the phone numbers, 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance, good from anywhere in the country. You can reach the Midday Show at 866-661-9309. And our email address is midday@wypr.org. Today, we welcome back to Midday culture commentator Sherry Parks, Associate Dean in Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland College Park, who joins us at least once a month to talk about American pop culture. Sherry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Sherry's joining us from College Park. Here in the studio with me is Nathan Connolly, assistant professor in history at Johns Hopkins, and author of his first book coming up later this year, A World More Concrete, Real Estate and the Remaking of Jim Crow in South Florida. It's published by the University of Chicago Press later this year. Nathan Connolly's scholarship has covered racism, politics, business, and property rights. We welcome you to the show today as well, Nathan. Welcome back to Midday. Nice to see you again.
Thanks, Dan. Good to be here.
The way this story evolved over the weekend, here it is. What day is this? This is Wednesday. Right. This whole thing kind of blew up on Saturday and Sunday. What is your reaction to what has transpired over just these few days?
When I first heard the tape, the first installment and the second installment, it obviously was kind of shocking. You don't really hear that kind of frank language around race much anymore, and there's actually a reason for that that I'd be happy to discuss. But it's kind of interesting to think about how the fallout around this is now going to rest on whether or not you can get the team out of Sterling's possession. And this is kind of an unprecedented move insofar as compromising the property rights of an NBA team owner because he was engaged in some kind of untoward, non-business related conversation, right? I mean, the link between his personal beliefs and his business practices has been made pretty direct, and some people haven't even tried to make an argument as to why you should, in fact, make him suffer consequences that have economic, you know, ramifications for something that was ultimately his personal beliefs.
Right.
There's a funny kind of set of disparities about NBA ownership generally that I think are kind of striking when you just think about the numbers on their own. First, you have over 3/4 of all the NBA players are African-American, but less than half of the coaches in the NBA are black. And only 2% of the owners in the NBA have majority ownership and are African-American. And that 2% is actually constituted by one person, and that's Michael Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
When you flip it the other way, obviously, you see that 98% of the owners in the league are white. And that's not a political problem until you have the remarks from Don Sterling. Right. And there's a reason, I think, that we can unpack as to why those kinds of disparities only become political problems when certain kinds of utterances are made in public, or at least that they become public.
Sherry, how about you? What's your reaction to these events of just the last 4 or 5 days?
Well, I think, first of all, I think we are shocked by these comments in public. There's research, and it's sports-related research, that fans and patrons of sports often do say racist things in private. There was a study done actually here at the University of Maryland where the sports fans patted the players on the back as they ran. This was a football study, as they ran through into the game and then returned to making racist jokes. So what we're shocked by is that this was supposedly private. There was a third person in the room, so we could argue about that. But not whether or not people still have lots and lots of implicit racism. I think the point about this in terms of property is really interesting, because there's always been a subtext, despite the mythology of equality of sports, of the plantation. And interviews that have been done with players have said we are very aware of this plantation's not only set of manners, but business structure, where the bodies of often men of color are enriching the wealth of often men who are not of color.
I want to play an audio clip here, first of the commissioner of the NBA. Let's hear from him, just a little bit of what he had to say yesterday.
I am personally distraught that the views expressed by Mr. Sterling came from within an institution that has historically taken such a leadership role in matters of race relations, and caused current and former players, coaches, fans, and partners of the NBA to question their very association with the league.
Also, yesterday, Oprah had something to say about this. She came out of a hotel. I saw the video of this from the TMZ website, where I've spent more time in the last 2 days than I've spent in the last 2 years, the TMZ website. We're going to talk about TMZ during this hour of the show, Sherry and Nathan. So Oprah comes out. She makes one comment about the story, the Sterling story, and then another comment about TMZ I thought you'd find interesting and amusing. Let's listen to Oprah.
Any advice to the Clippers organization and Doc Rivers and stuff?
You know, I don't have any advice, but all I got to say is we're all off the plantation.
That's
plantation days are over. But TMZ, my goodness.
I know.
You guys must be doing the hula since you broke this story,
it's
right?
Crazy, right? Since they broke the story. There have been so many other stories from it.
How did
so
that happen? How did that? Did she call you?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know but that, about that.
Yeah, well, we're all wondering about the latter part of that. But Sherry and Nathan, I want to go to you for the term plantation, such a fraught term when it's used like that. What is its meaning? What is Oprah trying to tell us there in regard to this story, do you think?
Well, obviously, it's hearkening to slavery, and it's hearkening to a moment when black slaves were used to enrich white slave owners to a profound degree. Oftentimes, when you think of the social structure of the plantation, you think of the large kind of big house with a master and a mistress and dozens, sometimes hundreds of slaves. So there's kind of an inequality of numbers. Even when there's a black majority, they're still enriching a kind of white minority. And that's clearly being invoked here in the case of the NBA and those numbers I cited earlier. The other thing that I think is important to keep in mind is there's a kind of paternalism that is fueling this particular enterprise. And one of the ways that I think the past is revisited in terms of the present is some of the remarks, even from Sterling in his phone conversation, talk about the extent to which he's buying houses, he's buying cars, he's subsidizing the lifestyle for these NBA players. And there's actually a far less distant kind of reference here that seems very familiar to me, and that's, of course, the Jim Crow South, because these kinds of disparities, you know, the majority of black residents being on property owned by minority whites, is reflected in the Jim Crow city of the South. And the way that that stayed the case for so long, and again, did not become a dire political problem until the 1950s and 60s, was because of the politics of paternalism, and more pointedly, because of the politics of racial uplift within the black elite. There's another kind of sidebar to this conversation, which is not just Sterling's racism or his ownership, but the support he has from the NAACP chapter in Los Angeles.
A couple of times, right?
Right.
They've cited him as, I don't know, Man of the Year, but they've given him awards, right?
That's right. Yeah. So Leon Jenkins, the head of the NAACP in California, came to his immediate defense, and there's a sense that Sterling was engaged in a history of donations as a way of providing a certain kind of political cover, especially after the 2006 case of him using engaged in housing discrimination kind of came to the fore.
But let me ask Sherry, NBA players aren't slaves. I get what Nathan's saying, but they're pretty well paid and live quite well, live better than many Americans, millions of Americans.
Well, and that is a material fact in terms of money and property, but the culture and the mythology always lag behind that. And there's still scholarship that's going on right now about the links between slavery and sports, some of it being done here at Maryland. Michael Cassiano, who's from Baltimore. The first professional athletes in the United States were slaves. You can go sport by sport by sport. And so that lineage is still there. And the idea that Sterling can say, I am buying houses, he didn't say, these men are performing labor and I am compensating them, and then they are buying. Notice how he collapsed that. Mm-hmm. And that gets back to the paternalism. There is still that idea, that trope that runs through sports. How often do we hear, well, these people shouldn't be making this much money. They're just playing a game. Well, anybody who knows an athlete knows how hard they work, and they nobody questions whether the people in the box who are not expending their bodies and with football, even their brains, should make that amount of money. So there's always been this really hard, fast division between how the players are treated. And I think that this will be one of the aftermaths, because the players have behaved very differently, first with the demonstration and then with the threat of a league-wide boycott.
Right.
So here the players are rising up and acting like employees who know they have rights.
I mean, I would agree 100%. And I think part of the swift justice you see from Silver has to do in some respects with putting a kind of genie back in the bottle, right? Because we don't want to let this get beyond a simple kind of, you know, single owner with a racist rant and become a conversation about labor practices or endorsements or more kind of collective bargaining discussions. You know, when you look at the way that property owners, again, throughout the 20th century, when they have a kind of black majority that they're making money from, have behaved, there's always a sense that you help black kids go to school or you help to support some kind of black businesses. Again, landlords in the Jim Crow South were helping blacks register to vote in some cases, as long as they voted in favor of initiatives that they, in fact, wanted to do. So propping up the ghetto economy. I have one landlord in my book, actually, who I describe, who's buying Christmas dinners for his tenants as a way of kind of shoring up their support, right, in light of terrible housing conditions, because this is the other side of that equation. With all of this paternalism comes a fight against housing reform, a fight against tenant organizing and unions. You have a kind of insulation of those tenants who lose their lives in fires. And the consequences of this particular incident, again, I think, are trying to keep us from having a bigger conversation about capitalism and sports in the 21st century. Right, this kind of asymmetry between those who are making a lot of money and using philanthropy as a way of basically shielding themselves from criticism. And I'd love to see that discussion open up.
It'd be very interesting following that to see what happens here. If they force the sale of this club, who ends up buying it? Perhaps
That's right.
A coalition of retired NBA players,
perhaps
majority African American. And one other thing I want to say here, I posed the question at the top of the show in the billboard for this hour. Are we seeing a new phenomenon here? You can't get away with this anymore. Sterling is speaking to V. Stiviano, who has been described in the press as half Hispanic, half African American, mixed, very young, right? To me, she represents this new face of America. And he's speaking to this new face of America, he thinks, in private. And you can hear in that conversation that she's fighting back. She's fighting back. She finds what he's saying unacceptable. We don't know how this recording was made, who leaked it to TMZ, but we know that this is a conversation between him and this new American, I'll call her, right? And I wonder, in our more diverse society that we're seeing today, it's just going to be what this story represents is that you can't get away with it, even in private conversation.
Right.
Let me just leave that hanging there for a minute as we take our first break. Nathan Connolly is with me in the studio from Johns Hopkins. Sherry Parks, Midday contributor, our culture commentator, associate dean in arts and humanities at College Park, joining us from there. We'll come right back and take some phone calls. Bunch of phone lines. Well, we got a couple phone lines still open, but folks have a lot to say about this. We want to hear from you. We'll get right to it after this break. Welcome back to Midday. Wanted to get Nathan Connolly's comments about what I said about my observation about Sterling and V. Stiviano and that conversation. Also, I'd love to hear what Sherry has to say about that.
Right. You know, you were mentioning, Dan, about this kind of being a new American and her fighting back. I mean, I think in both respects, in terms of her romantic relationship with Sterling and her resistance to his kind of racist ideas, she reflects a very kind of old Americanism, right? I mean, you have on one level major black white property owners who have intimate relationships with black people and see no problem with it at all. It's actually part of their portfolio or their kind of ownership, right, where they exercise their access to young women's bodies. I mean, Sterling clearly falls in that line. But Stiviano is no shrinking violet, right? I mean, this resistence against his racist sentiment, even as she's taking advantage of his economic kind of strength, I mean, she's able to at least participate in some kind of pushback against his ideas. And that kind of dance, even accessing certain kinds of resources while pushing back against the most vitriolic racism, is also a part of the American story.
Interesting. Yeah. Sherry?
Well, I agree. If you look at the work on Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, which is a very similar relationship, in their private conversations, it was reported that she pushed him on slavery. And so there's this relationship that upholds the slavery, slave owner, slave woman relationship, but in private they have these conversations. And I mean, but it must be said that when she, although she taped it, which by the way would have been illegal in Maryland, she later said that she did not expect it to harm him. So even though she's pushing back, she thinks that he has enough wealth and power that this will not hurt him as much as it has.
Hmm. Let's go to the phone lines and get comments from our listeners. And I welcome Sherry Parks and Nathan Connolly. You're welcome to comment on what you hear from our listeners here on Midday. 410-662-8780. We'll start with Tisha in Mount Vernon, right here in downtown Baltimore. Hi, Tisha.
Hi. First of all, I have to say that I took a class with freshman Nathan Connolly, and it was awesome. I cannot wait to get his book.
Way to go. All right. Thank you.
Okay, so I have a kind of interesting look on this. I think that the response was so quick and immediate because we don't have a lot of African-Americans as stakeholders in the actual NBA. As far as mass media is concerned, we have people like Jay-Z, we have people like Oprah, we have people like Kanye West. We have quite a few people who are able to grasp a huge part of the populace and draw their attention to something like this. So that may have had something to do with it. I don't know if you agree or if you have anything to say about that.
It partly speaks to what I was talking about. This is a different world. I mean, it's been a long struggle with racism in the United States. It's still here, obviously, but this is a different world that we live in.
Yes and no. I think on the terms of Jay-Z's ownership, for instance, he had less than 5% stake in the Brooklyn Nets. But his person was used to justify the expansion of the Nets organization into Brooklyn to help gentrify that community, right? So you can mobilize kind of black symbols as a way of getting other kinds of conversations off of the table, right? Mm-hmm. Whether or not this is another case of urban renewal, for instance. You know, the other thing that I think is key here is the focus on language is actually a sign of the weakness of our civil rights apparatus, right? Again, remember, Sterling's anti-discrimination case came down in 2006. There was no blowback. There was no huge uproar. And I had the opportunity to speak with an attorney who successfully sued Sterling in 2006. And he basically said, I don't mean to suggest that there is anything less heinous about what Sterling said on tape, but I am frustrated and vexed by the lack of public outcry about the housing discrimination for which we sued him.
He was a landlord.
That's right.
And he was sued for refusing to rent.
That's right.
To Latinos, blacks, people with children. He
That's
lost.
Right.
He ended up settling the suit, paying millions of dollars.
That's right,
right?
$2.7 million. In blatant violation of the law. But there's a bigger story, I think, about what happened to the civil rights enforcement apparatus in the wake of the 1970s and 80s that leads us to focus more on language.
You know, Sherry, what I meant by this being a different world is, as Tisha was saying, I think there are more, obviously, more African Americans in positions of influence and power, certainly in the culture, so that something like this. One day and it's over with. He's outed. It's there. And you've got the President of the United States condemning it.
Well, and I think that is a shift. I agree with Nathan that much of the power structure has not changed. But now that there are enough African Americans to change the consequences of those actions, at least somewhat, is different. I do want to speak to the timing issue. I think the timing has everything to do with the playoffs.
Interesting.
That this is the moment of time of the year when basketball gets a lot of our attention. Basketball's prominence has been actually shrinking a little bit, and football's has been growing. And right as the playoffs are taking off, they couldn't suffer this kind of scandal without trying to address it. Also, I think there's a second audience, and it's black grandmothers. Mothers and grandmothers have a lot of influence on where and how their sons play sports. You're talking about a league that's still 75% African American, and we know that if those women feel that this sport is not a good one for their sons, they will direct them elsewhere. Ask any sports recruiter how they would have handled this in terms of recruitment. And so the league itself had a lot to lose.
That's a great point.
Let's go to Aaron in Baltimore and welcome him to Midday. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that it's a tremendous shame all around. We have the shame of having a prominent figure in the NBA who is a blatant and unabashed racist. And we have the shame of what is probably an illegal recording, because in California, they also require both party consent. So it's just a series of wrongdoing on all parties. And some people might have had a greater part in wrongdoing than others, but it's just a series of information flows that are all wrong.
Yeah. Aaron, thank you for your comments here. TMZ. Sherry, you want to comment? I asked you if you think about that a little bit and comment about this celebrity website and the idea that if you've got a grievance with somebody or anybody, really, for any reason, racism or whatever it is, you can go to TMZ now and they'll publish just about anything, it seems like.
Well, and it's interesting because there are two steps here. One is the legitimization of what's basically yellow journalism again. Remember, we went through this with the National Enquirer, where they began to break hard news stories, or at least what were treated as hard news stories. Now, but when you bring in the internet and cell phones as a whole nother layer, and the idea that what it was once not necessarily legally protected speech. In this case, you're right. It's not clear whether this is legally protected, but certainly private enough that we couldn't get to it. Now you have technology that lets us get to it, and then TMZ, who's willing to run, sometimes erroneously, but will run with these recordings and put them out there, and then the hard news people and the highly respected outlets like WYPR then pick up the story and run with it. So I think you're right. When that piece that you ran between Oprah and the TMZ reporter, she's saying, wow, I mean, you've now stepped into the big league. And they have. We're paying attention to them.
Nathan?
Yeah, I mean, I want to build off of what the caller said, because I think he was focusing a lot on the law. And so much about this case shows how little the law is actually of consequence, right? Again, Donald Sterling broke no law. But he broke a really sacred kind of cultural mori that we hold very close. And his consequences, as you can see, are to the tunes of millions and millions of dollars, right? And so TMZ is interesting because it sits at a place where now people are adjudicating in the court of public opinion, and it has a disproportionate advantage. We can break news stories in real time. The way that even release the recording in bits and pieces, right, kind of ramping up the sense of anxiety about this and the anger about it. It wasn't a full release of the whole thing. I mean, they know exactly how they're pulling those strings, and of course it created these these dramatic consequences.
Let's go to Jay in Baltimore for his take on this. Welcome to Midday, Jay.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it. I think that WIPR is feeding on the yellow journalism by discussing this ridiculous topic. I think it's dangerously irresponsible of all of us to deal with somebody's household conversation of an 80-year-old person who obviously, you know, has given and has a lifetime achievement to the NAACP. I think that, you know, obviously, you know, people say things at home that are wrong. We have no idea what the context are. We don't know how badly he was baited on this stuff. I just think that, you know, by all of us jumping in, by all of us having this conversation, I mean, there are some hugely important topics out there, and we're talking about stuff that, I mean, should never be discussed. I mean, the more we discuss race, the more we create a topic of race, the more we react on race, the more chasm of identity we create in our population. I mean, to my mind, I think that we just stop discussing and reacting and looking at people who discuss things that are racially biased and look at them as being old, period. You look at them as old people who have old views that are just senile, you know, and that's just, you know, we gotta look beyond this now. We have to stop identifying people and stop reacting and letting the media bait us into these topics.
Hear my guests respond to that. Sherry, then Nathan.
Okay, which one of us jumps in there first?
Sherry, go ahead.
This is a really important moment in American history. This was not an isolated comment. He had been saying these comments for years and years and years and getting away with it. And I think this is a moment of cultural shift, because there will be a silencing that comes on, that where people's hearts may not change, but their behavior will. And I see that as a step toward progress. I mean, the theory that we have to wait for everybody to die, well, I'm not sure we have that long. There's still people younger than he who hold these attitudes who have a lot of wealth and power. And to stop seeing race is dangerous while the playing field is still not even, and it's nowhere near even.
I love this caller, and I love the fact that he's willing to say things that most people believe based on certain kinds of polling and how we are supposed to think about the past and the role that the past plays. There's a real kind of willful amnesia, so the fact that we can put it out there and talk about it, I think, is important. What's mm-hmm. important also here, though, is to think about what happened in the mid-60s when we were allowed to create social policies that dealt with racism because there were simply disparities and inequalities. And through the 1970s, and certainly through the Reagan era in the 1980s, there was a new legal standard called discriminatory intent that became the primary way that we were adjudicating civil rights violations. What it basically means is you have to prove that somebody had not just a discriminatory consequence, but a discriminatory purpose behind what they laid out or what they intended to do. It's so difficult and nearly impossible to prove that somebody intended to be racist that moments like Sterling's become these jewels where you can say, look, here's what's going on in the hearts of minds in America.
A flashpoint.
American case law is hanging on whether or not we can now prove whether or not somebody had deeply seated racist ideas. When we were dealing with the issue of Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman, we were kind of parsing these grainy 911 tapes to see if he used a racial epithet. Or when you think about the issues of affirmative action or housing discrimination. In Baltimore, this was a huge issue around housing because they tried to sue, the NAACP tried to sue Wells Fargo for reverse redlining. That case fell apart in 2010 because they could not prove that Wells Fargo meant to discriminate against African Americans, even though they used black churches to access black populations in the city. So what did the NAACP do? They then sued Wells Fargo on behalf of the city of Baltimore because Baltimore lost $14 million in its tax base as a result of this reverse redlining practice. Again, it fell through because of discrimination. Intent. So what the final consequence was that Wells Fargo became a donor for the NAACP. It had such bad press that it gave the organization $8 million in donations and helped raise another $3 million at its annual convention and helped build a financial literacy center down in Shaw in Washington, D.C. That's how civil rights now works in America, because people aren't allowed to adjudicate on the basis of disparity. They have to use this hearts and minds approach. And it's a problem.
And following right along from Nathan Connolly's comments, we have Mike in Baltimore who wants to add to that. Mike, thank you. Go right ahead and make your point, please.
Yeah, my point is that actually that was just covered pretty well. But the NBA and the Players Association is completely disingenuous. They had no problem with Wells Fargo back when Wells Fargo was pulling the hoodwink that it did on Latino and African Americans. They paid $175 million fine. So why is it okay for Wells Fargo to get away with it? Just with a wink, wink, we didn't do it. Mm-hmm. But this guy, he's a horrible person. There's no doubt about it. But we didn't have a problem when he was doing his predatory lending stuff out in California years ago. I think it was 2007. Why the big change now? Just because TMZ caught him? Mm-hmm. TMZ is not the Mara arbitrator here. It should be. The NBA should have been over this, all over this years ago.
Thank you for that comment, Mike. And I will add this, until I don't follow the NBA that closely. I'm a sports fan, but I don't follow the NBA that closely. But I never heard of Donald Sterling before the weekend.
Right.
And then I start reading things about him and his history, his the suit that Elgin Baylor brought against him, the housing discrimination case that he had to settle, and wondered, this is what I always wonder, when something like this leaks out, mm-hmm. you know, a private conversation, we're appalled that a private conversation leaks out, right? But what about all the other people that he might have made comments to, especially, and particularly white people, who might have been uncomfortable or comfortable with what he had to say? Either way, never said anything about this. I mean, I guess apparently, you know, he has a history of this. What do we base that on? The discrimination case against him? I guess that's it,
in part, in his own testimony, right?
In his own testimony in that case.
In that case, yeah, where, okay. where he talks about things he said okay. about blacks and Latinos.
But the owner of a sports franchise did not spend his life in solitary. He's out. He's at parties. He's entertaining people at the games.
Right.
Who knows what he's doing with his other enterprises? He encounters lots of different people. So anyway, I just wanted to make that point. And as far as, you know, we're sick of this conversation, stop having this conversation, stop talking about race and racism will go away. Mm-hmm. To my white friends, I said, no, I don't think you can do that. We're not at the end of history and we're not at the end of that story.
Unfortunately, that's the logic of the Supreme Court, right? And that's the terrain in which we're now trying to solve some of these problems. And so we can't run from that mentality. I think we really have to step up to it.
Let me take one more call.
And that's why,
I'm sorry, Sherry, go ahead.
Well, and that's why this is really important, because Nathan was pointing out the difference between what happens in the courts and what happens in sports. Sports are a type of religion in this country. And I mean that in its most liberal, literal way, that here you have something where people expect it to be moral.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
mm-hmm.
what, and this is something they can wrap their brains around. This is personal. So housing discrimination and legal strategies are difficult, and they're not nearly as emotional, although the consequences can be very far reaching. And that's why the court of public opinion has become even more important in this day and age, because that is sometimes is the only way that the public can raise its voice.
Thank you, Sherry and Nathan. We'll take one more call here before our next break. Again, our phone number, 410-662-8780, if you'd like to join our conversation at midday. Amadou, thank you for holding. We'll go to you next, Amadou.
All right. Thank you, Dan. Before I start on the get-go, I would like to say I'm not here to defend things that this man say. We all agree that those statements were horrible and unacceptable. But what I would like to point out here is the fact that we shouldn't forget that those conversations were held in a privacy, a man talking in his house and stating his opinion. You know, we all have opinions, things that we say in private that we don't want to be taken out in public, that we will not say in public. So we should take that in consideration and perhaps just leave him alone. He's an old man, and let him just be miserable with his opinion and the way he thinks about black people.
Yeah.
But we shouldn't just take this as a... we have to be careful. If we all have to be taken to be sentenced because of things that we say in private, I think we need to be a little bit be careful
okay.
about this issue.
It's interesting. The Sterling story follows the is it Cliven Bundy?
Cliven Bundy.
This
yeah.
is a story I've yes. tried not to pay attention to, because I saw that video and it's just a, you know, to me, an addled old man talking,
right.
and I didn't feel sorry for him, but I just didn't. We chose not to even talk about it here on midday,
mm-hmm.
but I see the you know, a similarity here, also a difference. Cliven Bundy made statements in public in front of a TV camera and to the New York Times, right?
That's right. That's right.
And this is a private conversation. But what did the NBA commissioner say? It's out. It's there. It's been.
He said it.
He said it. He acknowledged that he said it.
Right.
So it's there. And I don't think the First Amendment protects you against the government from infringing on your right to free expression, but it doesn't insulate you from criticism for what you say, however it comes out.
That's right.
That's all
right.
I would say to Amadou. Yeah, so. Yeah, Sherry.
And can we address this? We need to address this public sphere versus the private sphere, this hard line that people are drawing. First of all, and often people pull in the Constitution, I mean, this sense of privacy that we have is actually quite new. It's not something that the founders would have recognized, this idea that there's a private sphere that doesn't have anything to do with the public sphere and vice versa. But when somebody says things in private that affect their behavior, and there's lots and lots of evidence that what people say in private then feeds over into their public behavior. We then do have to worry about what they, not what they say and when they say it, but what they do and what influences what they do.
Nathan? Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think really helped to let this moment become a widely understood violation, again, of the social code was the response of corporations, right? The immediate corporate withdrawal of support for Sterling's enterprise. And again, there's a really important story here about how corporations have, on the one hand, and with all that we talk about in terms of deregulation and offshoring, they also became the principal vehicle through which people exercise their attempts to secure their civil rights, right? Jesse Jackson was really affected with this in the 80s, other activists in the 90s, right, through boycotts and the like. And this is really a major issue in terms of money. And if you simply have the air of untoward thoughts or uncharitable racial philosophies coming out of someone who has that much money going into his operation, it can't hold together. There's no way, because the consumers are going to speak. And so much of this blowback, again, has less to do with violation of the law, but more to do with the collection of capitalists who are owners, State Farm, all these major donors who are saying, you know what, this guy's toxic and we have to pull out.
Nathan Connolly is assistant. Sherry, we've got to take a break. Sure. We'll be right back. Nathan Connolly, assistant professor in history at Johns Hopkins, and Sherry Parks joining us from College Park, where she's associate dean in arts and humanities. A short break here. You're welcome to call us 410-662-8780 or send me an email that I'll read on the air, midday@wypr.org. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here with Nathan Connolly from Johns Hopkins University, and joining us from College Park, Sherry Parks, our Midday Culture commentator, associate dean in arts and humanities at the University of Maryland. Sherry, I'm sorry I had to cut you off there. What did you want to add?
Well, I just think that this is an interesting point in terms of morality and the market and the larger context, because we've been told for a while now that there's a certain morality in the marketplace, believe in the marketplace. At the same time, individual businessmen have not been held up to a moral standard. There's a contradiction in there. I mean, legal standards, yes, but not moral. And corporations work really hard to appear moral and to appear politically neutral. And I think holding up this mirror in a way undercuts that paradox.
Thank you, Sherry. I want to read an email from Dee in Pasadena, again, speaking to Donald Sterling's privacy, his rights. Dee says, it is a very slippery slope when personally expressed views and comments, no matter how hateful, can lead to economic prosecution. What happens to First Amendment rights? Why is the Westboro Church allowed to scream vile comments in public, but we prosecute a private person having a private conversation in his own home? I do not endorse his views, but for somebody who grew up during communism, this brings up uneasy emotions. And again, I would just say he's not being prosecuted. Donald Sterling is being
censured.
He's being criticized in the public place, in public. The government is not prosecuting him for what he said. And Nathan, you made that point earlier.
That's right. No, they prosecuted him for his housing discrimination, and he settled for a large sum. But this is a group of owners who are their own private club, who have their own constitution, own membership guidelines, and they're basically exacting a punishment based on the terms that Sterling himself signed to be a member of that club. That would hold in any court of law.
Let's go to another caller, Ed in White Marsh. You're on Midday Next. Hi.
I just like to say I listened to the fellow who called and said we shouldn't be talking about things like this in this day and age. And I'd like to point out that when you talk about what other people say and other people do, you're basically participating in gossip. And gossip, sociologists will tell you, is a very important part of establishing a society's, what you guys have been calling sort of our higher social order, what they would call our mores. That it's through talking about what other people are doing and saying in either a disapproving way or an approving way, that we teach the younger generation and even figure out for ourselves what it is that we find either truly abhorrent or becoming truly abhorrent. For example, murder is illegal, but cannibalism is against our mores. It's just totally abhorrent. And you might prosecute or not prosecute somebody, but in the court of public opinion, we would be discussing it, you know, because it is a bit against the mores.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much. Another caller, Richard, up in Delta, Pennsylvania, just over the line. Richard, thank you for calling Midday.
Thank you very much for accepting my phone call.
Sure.
I want to reiterate, where is love? Where is kindness? Where is the issue of people sharing with their neighbors and their friends a positive outlook on life, helping other people? I think this does point out shortcomings, and hopefully we'll learn from the shortcomings, not necessarily make it punitive, but I think the actions taken were reasonable. I want to reiterate, we need to change. I am an older person. I have learned how to change my habits and my outlooks on people, and younger people need to hear that. It's not an age issue. It's a mentality issue. And I hope that we learn from this experience. And I thank you.
I thank you, Richard. Thank you for those comments.
It's hard to be a neighbor when your landlord is trying to evict you unlawfully, right? And I'm all for using love and being neighborly, but we really need to make sure that part of being loving is also pursuing justice, right? And again, justice in this case is a little bit harder to parse, but again, it was Sterling's track record. And again, with the broader problem of inequality and discrimination, I mean, this should be an invitation to start to add some new kinds of protection and really think about how it's not enough to simply think in terms of hearts and minds. Because absent this recording, Sterling would still be in full standing, right?
Right.
How many times are we going to have to rely on a disgruntled girlfriend or some kind of weird moment we can actually get someone on tape to then create a paper trail that leads to some other kind of conversation about much more substantive questions of justice? We can't count on that now.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we should look at the moment, the Sterling moment, as a way to say our previous standard of hearts and minds and thinking about what people are only saying instead of what they're doing is not going to be enough anymore.
And there was love at the playoffs last night when people were holding
excellent
up signs
point, yeah.
of racial of unity and we are one. It came full circle with people then doing, we did what gossip does. I mean, we shamed somebody and then we came around and said, this is what we want.
Thank you, Sherry. Here's a comment from Sohaila in Baltimore who says, so many racist attitudes have gone underground because we just don't say those things anymore. Sterling's comments make clear how robust racism is in our thinking. I wonder if these public punishments are going to aid anti-racist agenda or simply cover them up by prohibiting the commentary, not the underlying attitudes. Kathy in Parkton, a comment by email. I wonder if his comments would have caused such an outcry if they had been directed at women. Had they been sexist instead of racist, would we even be having this conversation? And although I think his comments are reprehensible, it does bother me that he is being punished not for actions, but for thoughts and expressing those thoughts. I think there is a danger in punishing thoughts rather than actions.
Can I just respond to that and say that the comments were sexist? Right, there's a reference in the comments about Stiviano's kind of sexual activity and who she can and can't sleep with,
yeah.
right? I mean, the whole relationship is built on an asymmetry along gender lines. The difficulty, unfortunately, is when there are women of color involved, it's hard to see sexism. It's hard to see, you know, anything beyond your typical kind of black or white story. I mean, these things are going to be deeply embedded. And I think we should certainly treat this incident as much about sexism as about racism.
Sherry.
Oh, I agree. And here we are talking about a sport where masculinity, what often is called hyper-masculinity, is front and center. And so gender and the way in which men's bodies, if we're talking about women versus gender roles are very important in this story. This idea of men as animals and men as brutes
mm-hmm.
becomes part of the story.
William in Baltimore, our next caller, you're on Midday.
Hi, Dan. How you doing?
Good.
Good. Just wanted to say, because I heard two of your callers insinuating somehow that the issue of racism is just something that's raised by old people. And unfortunately, that's not the case. If you go on some of these college campuses, you will see that even young people in their teens are still practicing racism against African-American students in some of these Ivy League schools. That's unfortunate. And to conclude that racism should be left alone because these people are already in their 80s, it's just complete nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. I agree with that. It's hard to make. You probably shouldn't make these big generalizations. Maybe it's just wishful thinking. And Nathan, you can say what you want about this, and Sherry, but I think as time goes by and our society is changing, the country is changing, maybe not attitudes, but certainly in terms of how the face of America has changed. And the more people, young people, millennials, or after that, have experiences with people of mixed races, of different ethnic backgrounds, more immigrants in the country, I think it's all for the better. I mean, I think it's a more diverse society coming up, and it's going to, I hate to use the word tolerant. I think some of this stuff is just going to go away. I know that goes back to that argument you said you can't accept, or Sherry said you can't accept. Just wait till they all die. I don't think it's like that. I think there's this other force coming on the other end of it that's changing our society. And pardon me if it sounds like wishful thinking.
No. I mean, there's no denying that the country is more culturally diverse, but I think we're actually losing diversity in perspective, right? I mean, one of the things that with all this kind of self-congratulations about the country being beyond the race problem or the extent to which you're even allowed to build cases around issues of inequality and discrimination, people are starting to believe more and more. I mean, going back to something that Sherry had mentioned, that the market is moral, right? That issues of private life should remain private. And this kind of resurgence of, you know, property entitlements in terms of, again, housing or in terms of, you know, your own private, school or club. I mean, all mm-hmm. of that is creating a kind of uniformity. Even the language around education now, it's almost, you know, uniform that people don't believe in the public sector anymore, the public schools anymore, because you have to use the markets to try to create equality. And so I would certainly say that culturally we can buy into the idea that we're changing a great deal and diversifying, but there's far less wiggle room for how we should respond. Even in the case of this Donald Sterling incident, the LA Clippers had a very small window of things they actually could have done and still maintained popular support. In contrast to the 1960s, where someone like Ali or Kareem Abdul-Jabbar or Jim Brown might have taken a far more militant stance in response to this and not necessarily have lost the kind of mainstream in doing so.
Interesting. Yeah. Sherry?
Well, I agree with you that the world is, and this country in particular, becoming more diverse, but I also think we're experiencing the backlash.
Hmm. Okay, let me read a couple of emails here. This one is from Emmanuel. I am appalled by Sterling's racist views, but I am resisting the urge to join the witch hunt to betray the modern principle of tolerance, that if you're just believing, believe whatever you want. I have no complaints against the NBA. They are catering to their customers. My complaint is against we the people. Michelle says, to the caller who is exhibiting willful amnesia, racist ideas are not just the purview of the elderly. It is everything. It is everywhere, overt and covert. Ask any student of the liberal Ivy League campuses of America. There we go. Another reference to college campuses. They also face discrimination. Ask those seeking housing and employment who face discrimination. In the words of Gandhi, your beliefs become your thoughts become your words become your actions. Your actions become your habits become your values become your destiny. Thank you very much for that, Michelle. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. If I didn't get to your comments today, I will on Midday Friday. Nathan Connolly is assistant professor in history at Johns Hopkins, and he has a book coming out later this year, A World More Concrete, Real Estate and the Remaking of Jim Crow South Florida, looking exactly at where you grew up, right?
That's Florida, right? That's right.
Nathan, so maybe we'll come back and talk about that. Nathan's area of interest and scholarship is in racism, politics, business, and property rights. It's nice to have you back on the show.
Thank you very much.
And Sherry, thanks for making time for us today. Sherry Parks, Associate Dean in Arts and Humanities at the University of Maryland College Park, is also the Midday Culture Commentator, and she will be back with us tomorrow. We have a very interesting conversation coming up on Thursday at 1 o'clock with Sherry Parks. Baltimore, is Baltimore losing its accent? A look at globalization's effect on regionalism, regional culture, regional identity. So, Sherry, I'll be talking to you tomorrow. You'll be in the studio with us, right?
Yes, see you tomorrow.
Yeah, thank you very much. And thank you very much right now to Breathe Bookstore Cafe, serving inspired vegetarian, vegan, gluten-free savories and sweets and more over on 36th Street in Hamden. They provide lunch to us on Wednesday. I also want to send props out to Atwaters for providing lunch to us on Tuesdays. They're opening a new Atwaters location in Canton Crossing, 3601 Boston Street, opening for lunch today. Folks, please stay tuned for the news from NPR, and then we'll see you for the second hour of our show.